things first. So manganites, and these are all nice words that some of them summarize the general topic of this workshop. I would say that inhomogeneities appear to be of particular importance in many of interesting materials. And the thought shown in red is that self-organization of cluster structures appears to be characteristic of many interesting materials and is responsible for many effects on them. So a couple of covers in physics today, of course. All right. So as I said, Jeff was kind enough to do all the introduction for me. So these are manganites. This is a famous phase diagram that Jeff has already shown. And the CMR effect is a transition from a non-metallic to a metallic state induced by a magnetic field. So we have a ferromagnetic metallic state here. And then the paramagnetic insulating or semiconductor, whatever you want, state here. So this is a CMR effect, this kind of a transition, which can be induced by the field, obviously, because the state is ferromagnetic. But also another kind of transition can be induced from this state, the charge or anti-ferromagnetic insulator, to ferromagnetic metal too. Okay. All right, so these two pictures kind of just illustrate the type of an effect. This is paramagnetic insulating to ferromagnetic, the first type of the CMR effect. This is kind of a size of an effect that you can get. In fact, the magnetoresistance is much, much bigger for the second type of a charge-ordered insulating to ferromagnetic metallic state transition. Here you can get, what, 6 orders of magnitude change in the resistivity, or you can even get 9. Of course, doesn't beat the superconducting state that Jeff mentioned today, but still, the effect is pretty dramatic. And one other introductory remark is that, in fact, in manganites, inhomogeneities are observed on a variety of length scales, not only the nanometer scale that we're discussing in this morning, but also we see martensitic states with inhomogeneities on a length scale of hundreds of microns, phase-separated states on a submicron scale, finally the nanoscale correlations that I'll be talking about. And it appears that a number of interesting effects in these materials, the giant effects, the CMR effect is one of the examples, appear because of the delicate balance between these coexisting states. So historically, the first example of this kind of an effect is the percolative phase transition, field-induced or temperature-induced. In this case, the length scale of the phase separation is of the order of microns, as you can see from these images. And this is an insulator to metal transition percolation type. Then there are, as I said, martensitic states there. The size of the different coexisting phases, the length scales are really huge, up to 100 microns. This is a very typical example of martensitic accommodation strain that stabilizes otherwise incompatible phases. And in fact, it plays a very significant role in ceramic samples where in general, effects of long-range strain can be controlled by, for example, changing the different grain size. And in fact, there are certain compositions in which by simply changing the grain size, you can induce an insulator to metal transition at low temperature material. So martensitic strains, long-range elastic strains are very important to these materials. All right. So homogeneous states are ubiquitous in manganites. And in many cases, they explain the character of various transitions, so on and so forth. Okay, but now to the main question, how do these inhomogeneities affect the magnitude of the CMR? So this is a CMR effect, and as Jeff started this morning, I will concentrate on the transition from the paramagnetic insulating to the ferromagnetic metallic state. Specifically, it's transition from this state to that state here. But before I move on, I would like to say a couple of words, and you'll see in a while why I need to do that, about the nature of this state in the phase diagram. This is a charge-ordered antiferromagnetic insulator. And these two sketches here basically explain what kind of state it is. At x equals to 1/2, it's kind of a checkerboard pattern. And this pattern was first proposed a long time ago in the 60s by Goodenough, who postulated the charge order, manganese 4+ and manganese 3+, and then the corresponding orbitals are shown here. It turns out that, in fact, the charge disproportionation, if present, is very small, and the actual valence of these atoms are close to 3.5. In fact, that probably slightly different. But what is important is the asymmetry of the electronic state there, and this is something that we can observe by doing resonant X-ray scattering, by basically looking at the distortions of the manganese-6 octahedra. So there are six oxygens surrounding manganese atoms here, and from the distortions of these oxygen cages, we can say something about the electronic state. Anyway, so this is a state that is observed at x equals 1/2. Right here, checkerboard pattern. As you move to higher calcium concentrations here, you change the doping level, and you correspondingly change the nature of the insulating so-called charge-ordered state. For example, this is x equals to 2/3 state, and then you get all kinds of states in between. All right, so I'll skip that. And once again, this is something that has already been explained this morning. This is basically the nature of the ferromagnetic state. It is a metal, and I will not dwell on that. The high temperature paramagnetic state is pretty insulating, much more insulating than a simple double exchange can explain. And so, and this happens because of the presence of local inhomogeneities. So the first type is a single polaron. It's basically a Jahn-Teller polaron. If you localize an electron here, then because manganese 3 plus ion is a Jahn-Teller ion, you have a distortion of the manganese 6 octahedron, right? The corresponding lowering of the electronic level here. And if you imagine that you have a random assembly of this Jahn-Teller distorted octahedra in the sample, then you will see it from diffuse neutron or X-ray scattering. And if this is this kind of a distortion, you will see butterfly-like patterns like this. So these patterns actually correspond from long-range elastic strains associated with this distortion. And once again, as Jeff said, there are correlated peaks. So if you think about it, the nominal number of manganese 3 plus ions near to the doping level 0.3 that corresponds to large CMR effect is huge, right? And therefore, you expect some correlations between these lattice distortions, or polarons, if you wish. And so, as Jeff has shown, there are correlations between these polaronic lattice distortions, and these correlations lead to the insulating character of the paramagnetic state, and I'll get to that picture later, actually. Wait, so, yes?
You said long-range strain. Could you give a number of how far out it stretches?
No, I cannot.
Well, if you say long-range, it seems to be bigger than something, at least.
Well, see, this is... Okay, so now, imagine that you have a distortion like this, right? Now, this is long-range elastic strain. So suppose that it just goes slowly like this with no characteristic length scale as a power of something. Okay. What is the length scale? There is none, right? Okay. And the long-range strain usually behaves like this. It's a power law function. So there is no length, no length scale.
How far out are the sizable type of distortions?
Once again, if it's a power law, you cannot really say. And now, what you experimentally observe, you observe a butterfly pattern like this, right? And the closer you get to the breakbeak, in fact, the farther you get in the real space. And you cannot really say anything from this kind of data, I would assume. It's hard to say. I mean, you have a long-range elastic distortion, then they start overlapping with elastic distortions coming from other polarons, and so it's probably actually the length scale is determined by the distance between these polarons, but from this kind of data, it's impossible to say. You can say about the correlation lengths of the correlated distortions from the width of the peak, but for single polarons, it's hard to say anything.
Sir, and did you say that these are large polarons or small polarons?
Small. Well, in this model, right, it's a small polaron, but it's a model, right? So. when I say a small polaron, this is a localized electron. It is sitting here, right? And then, of course, there is long-range elastic strain. But what defines a large polaron is that then you have an electron which is kind of spread, right? Now, when you have a, when you have polaronic correlations, right, you have regions of a certain finite size. And you can speculate that the electrons in these regions, you know, would be spread along, you know, within this region. I don't know. But it's just a model, right? And what we see lattice distortion. We cannot say anything about where the actual electron is sitting.
Do people know that in these samples, 30% that there's a charge disproportionality between the...
No. I mean, when at high temperature, when you only have the diffuse scattering... Wait, no, I'm wrong. In fact, there have been recent... I shouldn't say no like this. I saw some recent data showing that there are different manganese sizes, right? So
The trouble is that this is a whole now really localized on manganese. It's strongly hybridized with oxygen.
All right. It is strongly hybridized with oxygen. That's right. So for simplicity, I'm talking about manganese 3 plus and manganese 4 plus. But there is no manganese 3 plus, manganese 4 plus here. Charge disproportionation number one is small. Number two, manganese ions are really, really strongly hybridized with oxygen. So whenever wherever the electron is sitting, it's hard to tell, right? What I'm saying is that there is some evidence that at high temperatures there are distinct manganese sites in the system. But whether it's really telling you that you have charge disproportionation, I don't know. Okay. So now some experimental data. So this is a phase diagram of, well, neodymium strontium manganite, but it is almost the same as a lanthanum calcium manganite. So one can measure diffuse X-ray scattering at different doping concentrations. So there was a question this morning about how these all scattering depends on the doping concentration, so this is something that I'm going to show you now. This kind of picture I have already seen this morning once again, so this is a butterfly-like pattern due to the single polarons, and on the top of it there are these diffuse peaks, which we decided to call this morning polaronic correlations. All right. So you do scans, you see the peaks, you do them at different temperatures. You can extract the correlated part from this kind of scans and plot, for example, temperature dependencies. And as Jeff has shown, you see that there is a correlation between the electrical resistivity and the presence of the correlated polarons like this. Okay, now, one interesting thing is that this is the intensity of the correlated peak, which, if we are talking about small correlated regions, would correspond to the concentration of these correlated regions in the sample. This is the correlation length. This is the size of these regions, right? It's more or less temperature independent, well, within, of course, the huge error of the experiment. All right, so that gives you the length scale corresponding to the correlation length between polarons. And this is something of the order of, you know, 2-3 lattice units. So it is small. It is nanometer scale. Finally, at high temperatures, correlations disappear. So there seems to be some evidence for T star that Jeff has mentioned above, which you don't have polaronic correlations. In fact,
you know something like you just said, the intensity tells me what's the relative weight of the sample of this. Why couldn't it just be the size of the lattice distortion?
Well, it can. It can be the size of the lattice distortion.
Do you
know? Yeah, that's right. No.
Okay.
No.
When we know the immediate on-site distortion, a magnitude of tangential distortion is not.
Right, and it doesn't change as a function of temperature.
Right. So it's a natural interpretation to have a phase-separated picture.
So.
And how do we know that the local distortion of the antenna doesn't vary?
From PDF.
Okay.
But PDF measures both the single polaron part and the correlated
exactly.
polaron part. It doesn't distinguish between
right.
them, right?
But okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now, in addition, well, actually preceding scattering measurements, there are other indications for the presence of T star in this system. For example, you see changes in the behavior of the heat capacity at this temperature T star, and also there are anomalies in the electrical resistivity and optical conductivity at certain temperature, which again can be associated with temperature. Finally, Jeff's data. Okay.
Can we do this a little slower?
Yes. Well, but I won't able to give you any explanation
well,
here.
We're showing it for some reason, so then let's understand that.
All right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now this is the heat capacity measurements, right? Basically, in the same material, lanthanum, calcium 1/3. There are certain deviations. There is a certain change in the temperature-dependent behavior here and there, right? Mm-hmm. And that would roughly correspond to temperatures where you stop seeing the polaronic correlations, roughly, because these temperatures are hard to...
Well, what's the plot here? I mean, for three different materials?
These are lanthanum, calcium, lanthanum, strontium, and something else I cannot really say. So two different materials and something else, which
so
I can define.
More degrees of freedom, which we can excite, we can put more heat into the system at the temperature. We do not have the Jan-Teller distortion. That's what I have to read there.
That's what you have to read from this. Yes, I
we have an interpretation for that.
Not really. Well, I don't. It's probably.
So the correlation between the degrees between these polarons kind of disappears. Of course, I log them and I have less entropy in the system. Mm-hmm. I can maybe put less heat in. This is kind of the picture.
Probably, but I don't know what these guys say.
Well, when you correlate something, then you have effectively less degrees of freedom, right?
Yeah.
So
just from this simple entropic picture, yes. But once again, this sounds reasonable. But you should actually get to this paper and see what these guys have to say about this. I'm not really an expert on this measurement, right? You have them here. You don't have them there.
So the idea is that the correlations extend from T star to TC.
Right. Yes, from T star to TC, that's right. They're absent here, they're absent at higher temperatures.
Just
right.
Above TC, or just at TC. The correlations are largest just above
yes, TC. Just above the
but
TC.
But then they extend some way down into the ferromagnetic region.
That, in fact, is system dependent, and some of the systems, they extend to the very lowest temperatures. But just, you know, we have more inhomogeneous samples and less inhomogeneous samples, I would say.
So you think, okay.
But they're strongly suppressed. They're always strongly suppressed in the ferromagnetic state. You may see some remnant correlations.
Yeah.
Yes, but in my opinion, just saying that... Yeah.
In the optimally doped lanthanum and calcium manganese oxide, they seem to go away at low temperatures, but as you go away from optimal doping toward the size of the ferromagnetic boundaries,
mm-hmm. In the optimally doped neodymium strontium system, you always see them.
Yeah.
So see, it's different. It changes slightly from, but the major effect, the suppression of the correlations in the ferromagnetic state, is always there. Okay. All right. So what I wanted to say here is that there is other experimental evidence for T star other than just scattering measurements. So you can see anomalies in other quantities too. Okay. All right, well, this is a CMR effect, so I've shown you some temperature dependencies. Now you can induce the same effects by a magnetic field too. So you apply the magnetic field, the correlations get suppressed, so resistivity goes down in the magnetic field. The correlations go down in this particular system, they don't disappear, they just get suppressed. Once again, the correlation length, the size of this region, does not really depend on an applied field, does not really depend on an applied temperature. Okay, so that was x equals 2.3. Now we can get to other dopings, and this is what you get. The basic picture is the same. You always have the correlations at high temperatures. You don't have them in the ferromagnetic state. The correlation length seems to be very similar in various samples, really not depending very much on temperature or an applied field. However, the position of the correlation peak does seem to depend on the doping level in the following manner. So this is a doping level, And we've measured a number of different manganese, different compositions, not just lanthanum calcium, but a number of different compositions too. And this is what we get. So this is the latest modulation wave vector as a function of the doping level. You can get single crystals up to x equals 0.5 in various manganites, and in the bismuth calcium system, in fact, you can even go beyond 0.5. And this data shown beyond 0.5, in fact, well, only the green point here is taken by x-rays, and the rest was taken by electron diffraction, which you don't even need single crystals, right? The powder sample for electron diffraction is single crystal sample, right? Now, there seems to be a linear dependence. I don't know if there is any significance that this all this data seem to fall on this line. I know the error bars are pretty large, of course. Now,
you would expect that users or square root or something, right?
I don't know. I mean, all I want to say is that there seems to be this kind of a dependence on the doping level. So these peaks do move. Now, there is another line shown here. And remember the charge ord and the ferromagnetic state that I was talking about earlier in this talk. So this line here shows the latest modulation wave vector for the long-range ord low-temperature state there. It's a different line. It goes from 1 here to 1 there. So it has a different slope. Now, oh, it's just summarizing what I said. But what I really want to say is that, okay, the following questions arise then. What is the physical mechanism responsible for the correlations? What is the structure of the correlated regions? Are they static or dynamic? What is the role of the uncorrelated polarons? That's why I was only talking about the correlated polarons. All right. Now, as I am much less established than Jeff, I can speculate. Okay. If I say something wrong, it's not that important. All right. So going back to this plot here. Now, we know that the correlations are observed at the scattering vectors at which long-range charge order is also observed in these materials at lower temperature, right? So now we know that the charge order state is in fact
same material if long-range charge order. I thought at high temperature you get the insulating type of stuff, and low temperature you get a ferromagnet. Where is the charge order?
Let me go back.
So there's another material, but we had it as function of x, I thought.
This is okay. So the charge order state at low temperatures is observed here in this range of dopings.
Okay, so right, it's now than a half, then I have the charge.
Right now, okay, so we can measure the correlations anywhere here. Right. Okay.
Good.
This is the wave vector for the charge order state. This is the wave vector observed for the correlations.
Yeah.
Right. Same wave vectors, the charge order state as we know is insulating. So one possibility is that what we have there at high temperatures are little regions with charge in orbital order. However, it's a different wave vector. So now, experimentally then again, this type of order, the so-called C type, is observed at x equals 1/2 when the long-range order structure is found, but at high temperatures the diffuse scattering has it at x equals 0.3. Right. Now, at x equals 0.5, at high temperatures, then you would get this kind of structure in the correlated regions and so on and so forth. So one possibility, and this is a speculation now, there is no experimental confirmation for this, all right, that what we are observing at high temperatures are little regions showing charge in orbital order, but then they must be electron depleted in order to show this kind of structures. They must be electron depleted. This proposition is not as crazy as it sounds, because there are numerous theoretical predictions that, in fact, in these materials, you should get the electronic phase separation, meaning that you should get, at least in theory, regions showing higher or lower concentration of the electrons. And now I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes about things that I don't understand at all. So these are theoretical models that are usually used to describe these materials. And of course, manganites are very difficult, are very complex systems, so you have all kinds of interactions, you know, kinetic energy, Hund's rule coupling, interferomagnetic super exchange electron phonon interactions through the Jahn-Teller effect, electron-electron interaction. And here I'm throwing in a couple of models that are usually used to describe these materials. So one orbital, this is a classical ferromagnetic condor double exchange model in which no electron interaction present, no Coulomb interaction for the EG electrons, right? And the Jahn-Teller splitting provides splitting for EG orbitals, and you have one active orbital, so you get the following Hamiltonian. Or if you have more calculating power, you can consider a two-orbital model. So you have two EG orbitals coupled to Jahn-Teller phonons here. And for typical parameter values for manganites, you can try and construct phase diagrams. And what, I mean, depending on exactly how you do the calculation, what you neglect, and what kind of parameter you put in, you can get different phase diagram. But the common feature of this phase diagram is that you always get large regions in which you have the phase-separated state, and I'm talking about the electronic phase separation, so charge-rich, charge-depleted regions. That's what you would get if you try and solve this kind of models, right? So the model of charge-depleted, charge-rich regions is not that crazy in that respect, so it's quite possible. Of course, there are other scenarios, and we've got to consider them all at this stage. And there was a question, in fact, I think this morning, about whether you can distinguish what you observe, you know, correlated latest polarons from a classical charge density wave, right? And the answer was, it's very hard to distinguish these things, it may be impossible. So Fermi surface nesting, in fact, was shown in different type of manganites. These are layered manganites, and whenever you have a layered structure, the nesting effects, of course, are much stronger. And in layer 214 manganites, it seems that surface nesting is playing a role in producing nanoscale correlations. But thus far, there was no evidence for the importance of the nesting effects in 113 manganites. Then you can get continuously modulated phases in which you simply have short-range order correlation, right? So you don't really need to have complete phase-separated state. Of course, the experiments in general show that there are different kinds of manganese sites, but in principle, these kind of phases are not excluded. So I would say that experimentally, at this stage, we don't really know what is the nature of the correlated regions, so we may as well, for semantic purposes, continue calling them correlated polarons.
Well, this density wave is different than all the other ones we knew. This occurs along the cube edge, because it's 0.0.
Oh, this one, this one.
Well, that one on the right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
A special case that comes in the bilayer system.
That's right. It occurs in a different direction. I didn't want to really talk about that, but
right.
Jeff, you caught me. All right.
It is kind of a charge density wave.
It is a kind of a charge density wave.
It's special to the bilayer.
It's special to the bilayer. That's right.
And the point. That's the one that's been very well characterized. Measured, a couple of hundred reflections with X-rays and fit it to a model.
And perhaps this is the thing that is waiting to be done for the 113 manganites,
right,
too.
Yeah.
That's right. So someone just needs to have the courage to measure several hundred of these reflections and try and construct the model. That's all. Those, that's all there is.
Yeah.
Nah, not me.
How do you understand this? This is short-range charge ordering peak seen in the paramagnetic state with the charge separation.
With charge separation?
Yeah, because the charge separation model, you would expect you have clusters of charges that are fairly long ranged, and that in turn will give you rather sharp peaks in the reciprocal space.
No. I mean, if you have a real charge separation, you cannot get large regions, right? Just simply because of Coulomb forces, right? You can get small regions, but large Coulomb forces actually will prevent you from forming large regions. So you actually expect nanometer scale regions.
The growth of these samples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is consistent in that sense. But as I'm saying, there is no experimental proof at this stage. No. And something like that needs to be done. Whoever has the courage.
Let me ask you. In a previous slide, you mentioned perfect phase-like scenario,
mm-hmm.
I guess, of Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing in common with what you say now. It's not.
Oh, with this?
Yes.
Oh, I'm just throwing alternative scenarios. Mm. That picture with nanometer scale size regions, ordered regions, nanometer scale size, has nothing to do with these pictures here. These are two alternative scenarios that I'm throwing in, all right?
You can probably, just from the different positions of the peaks, estimate what the charge is, disproportionation ought to be in order to get the different peak positions matching.
I mean, this is modal dependent, right? If I'm assuming that these are charge ordered regions, then I can say something, yes. But
right.
It is, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's a very simple
answer. No, but right. But that also depends on the concentration of these regions, which we don't know.
But don't you know what for the peak position in comparison this with the behavior above 0.5, what the nominal concentration in the charge, locally charged ordered region is supposed to be? And then you just see how
right. So then you would know the nominal concentration. That's right. And you would know the nominal concentration. No, that really depends on the on how many of these regions you have in the sample.
You know the modulation, so you know the density.
Yes.
But you also know the charge which that's supposed to be in there.
Yes.
You know the average charge, and you can from the peak position infer what the local charge
yes.
in the charge ordered cluster is supposed to be in that scenario. And then
that's
you can
right.
see what the charge disproportionation, whatever the rest is supposed to be.
No, but don't you need to know how much of the correlated region and not correlated
yeah,
region?
That's
you have to assume that.
What you need.
Yes. I mean, you need some extra information to do that.
Problem. It hasn't been done. You could put the cross-section on an absolute basis and
right.
with at least a guess about what the distortion is. You can do that. But you also have the single polaron scattering versus the correlated polarons.
Now, once again, if you do something like this, you can say.
Right, yeah.
But.
In the qubit systems, people have taken like 20 Bragg reflections
mm-hmm. that's
to a model. And the CE model works pretty well, yeah. Whereas in this particular system,
yeah.
we're able to take it out to much higher numbers.
Several hundred, right?
Right, yeah, uh-huh. 103 or something. Mm-hmm.
It is possible, but
right. yeah.
just it hasn't been done yet.
Right. Yeah, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. It's one of these things that you're always thinking, you know, let's do this sometime later. All right. So now, experiment shows that...
I'm wondering about a definition, what we mean by the correlation. If for a theorist or for maybe anyone, any physicist, it would mean I have a certain correlation function and there's a typical landscape.
Yes.
And so what are we talking about? I could think about a displacement correlation function, density-density correlation function, spin-spin correlation function, orbital occupancy correlation function. What do we really know? In which of these functions do we have a tandem angstrom length scale? And I'm also wondering, to what extent do I have to distinguish this from the droplet picture, or is it the same? Could you be precise?
Well, it could be the droplet picture, number one. It can be the droplet picture, or it can be, you know, exponentially decaying correlation. We cannot say from this kind of a measurement, right? And we are talking about density-density correlation function here. So we are talking about latest distortions that we are observing with X-ray scattering.
So you would say the density-density correlation function does show a typical length scale of 10 angstrom.
Yes. I mean,
and that's the summary of all the complicated phenomena you've been observing so far.
That's right, but you see, it can also be a sharply defined droplet, right? That would, of course, produce different type of a peak shape, but the data are not good enough to look at the effects of the peak shape.
They cannot be distinguished.
We cannot distinguish, for example, from Lorentzian square, or even it's really hard to distinguish between in this measurements at least between Lorentzian or Gaussian shape, right? So it's just we don't have the reliable information on the peak shape here. So it can be like a classical exponentially decaying correlation, or it can be a sharply defined droplet. With this kind of data, wouldn't see any difference
within
them.
It's not really the data so much. I mean, the real problem is trying to sort out what's correlated and what's single polarized. You look at the data, and
that's what I'm wondering about.
Bump on the side of a big hill.
Yeah. Yeah. See, look at the data, right? Here, that's right. I mean, it's a bump on the top of the hill. Right, I mean, you can put different models for the hill.
It's as good as this.
Yeah.
It's not really the data.
Well, I mean, in a sense that the error bars are smaller than the size of the point here. But you also have this decaying, right, part. And you can model it. But then it becomes model dependent. Actually, thanks, Jeff. This is what I meant. Yeah, man. Okay. All right, so ferromagnetic metal, no correlations, paramagnetic insulator correlations present. But then what about the uncorrelated polarons? And in fact, the question I would like to address now is, does the presence of the correlations distinguish metal from insulator in the paramagnetic state? And what's the role of the correlations in the CMR effect itself? This is an important question, because if you think about it, all right, so we know that we have polarons in this material, or lattice distortions that we are describing as polarons, right? And they are not present in the metallic state, they are present in the insulating state. We know that if we assume the classical model of small polarons, then we should have huge number of them in the samples. So they correlate, not really surprising, right? But now whether these correlations are just a secondary effect or the primary effect causing the CMR, that's a question that I would like to address now. And in fact, nature turns out to be so kind that we can study manganese samples in the paramagnetic insulating state in which correlations are present and are absent. In manganites, the high temperature state, the high temperature insulating state, can be either orthorhombic or rhombohedral. Now, Jeff and I have shown you these pictures of the perovskite structure in the beginning of our talks, but in fact, the material is always slightly distorted from this ideal perovskite structure. The oxygen octahedra are slightly tilted, right? They are slightly distorted, and so in the zero solar approximation, these materials are perovskites, but there are little distortions that make them different from the perovskite structure. And the structure itself can be orthorhombic or rhombohedral, and I will say more about that a little bit later. It also turns out that in the range of dopings, in which you see the CMR effect, that is not too far from 0.3, the rhombohedral state is normally metallic in the sense that the resistivity grows as a function of temperature. The orthorhombic state is normally insulating, again at high temperatures, in the sense that the resistivity goes down as a function of temperature. And the CMR effect is big here and really small here, right? And now, you can even find systems, manganite systems, in which the system undergoes the orthorhombic to rhombohedral transition in the same sample. So now, if we look at this composition as a function of temperature, look at the diffuse X-ray scattering, this is what we observe. Low temperature material is a ferromagnet, pretty well conducting. We see some remnant correlation, but not too much. Then, as you go to the orthorhombic state, we have a lot of correlations present. And on the transition to the rhombohedral state, this is very sharp transition. You stop seeing the correlations, right? And there is also the corresponding drop in the electrical resistivity. And if you, now this is this sample, but if you study samples here on the rhombohedral side of the phase diagram, thus far where we were not able to detect the correlations, and here correlations are easily seen. So the rhombohedral state, and this is a sketch of the latest of the distortion in the rhombohedral state, it's paramagnetic metal. We see no correlated clusters. And if you do the refinement of the structure, you find that the manganese 06 octahedra are not distorted. Now, this is, of course, the average structure that we're talking about. The paramagnetic, the orthorhombic side, rather, in which we see charge in orbital ordered clusters, shows an average distorted manganese 06 octahedra. It can do this kind of measurements in a large number of manganite crystals. And this is a well-known phase diagram of magnetoresistive manganites showing dependence of Tc, this is the Curie temperature, as a function of a so-called tolerance factor. And tolerance factor simply tells you how far the perovskite structure is distorted from the ideal cubic structure. All right. So here the distortion is large, here the distortion is smaller. This side is orthorhombic, this side is rhombohedral. A number of measurements, colorimetric, thermal expansion, resistivity, magnetization, provide evidence that lattice effects are important here on the orthorhombic side, not so important on the rhombohedral side. Large CMR effect here, almost no magnetoresistance there. And so, scattering measurements show that correlated local lattice distortions are present here, not present there. All right? Now, but still, what about the uncorrelated polarons? Because once again, these correlations may be just the byproduct of the presence of a large number of uncorrelated polarons in the system.
This picture here, to understand this, on the left side, you would say the octahedra remain fairly rigid. Is that what you're saying? While on the right side, they get really, well, I don't know, bumps and whatever, and they really...
No, on this side, there are correlations. This is orthorhombic, so on average, octahedra are distorted. Mm-hmm. On this side, no correlations, and the octahedra, on average, are not distorted in the average structure. So it's the other way around.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes. All right, so now, single polarons. In fact, we know for many years now from Professor Gami's measurements that, in fact, polarons are present in the rhombohedral manganites from PDF measurements. If you do diffuse scattering, you see in the sample that I was talking about, the sample undergoing transition from the orthorhombic to rhombohedral as a function of temperature, then in the orthorhombic state, you see correlations and the butterfly-like pattern. At high temperature state, you lose correlations, but the butterfly-like pattern persists. So you should have some single polarons still present on the rhombohedral side. Now, the real question, though, is not whether these polarons are present or not, but whether they show any anomalies at the transition. Okay, so the way we tried and measured that was as follows. So it's kind of hard to distinguish single polarons from correlated polarons in the temperature-dependent measurements with X-rays, because with X-rays you integrate over the energies. So you not only see the local lattice distortions, but you also see phonons and, you know, thermal diffuse scattering, and it is temperature-dependent, it is Q-dependent. So it is hard to distinguish, to really extract, rather, single polaron intensity from the X-ray measurements. So we did neutron measurements in which you can do energy-dependent scans. So if you sit here on top of the correlation peak, you also have the intensity coming from the butterfly. You have intensity coming both from the uncorrelated and correlated polarons here. And if you do the energy scan, which would be in this direction, this is what you see. These are inelastic scans at fixed Q. This is energy at different temperatures. So at the lowest temperatures, well, we see some incoherence scattering at zero energy transfer. This is acoustic phonon. It's a normal acoustic phonon. It is resolution limited. So there is nothing interesting about this state. As you increase temperature, but still remain, this is a big increase from 30 to 200. This is a still ferromagnetic state. Then really nothing happens. Phonons don't change. You don't get any additional scattering. As you go, however, to the paramagnetic, orthorhombic state, there are significant changes. One thing is that you get quasi-elastic intensity. Quasi-elastic intensity, centered at Q equals to zero, very broad signal. Here, see, this is no longer horizontal. There is some scattering here. And changes happen at the elastic line. And if you go further to the rhombohedral state, the quasi-elastic scattering persists, and the phonons, acoustic phonons, get damped, but I don't have time to talk about this. That's fine, so manganites it is. Now, if you now analyze this data and additional scans that I haven't shown, this is what you find. Let me explain you what I have shown here. As a function of temperature, this is the electrical resistivity, right? So ferromagnetic metal here, paramagnetic orthorhombic, paramagnetic rhombohedral there. This picture here shows the intensity of the broad quasi-elastic scattering. And this here shows the correlated peak, which turns out to be almost, well, elastic or almost elastic. It's kind of hard to say from our measurements. So the correlations are elastic, and this is their temperature dependence, right? More or less following the temperature dependence of the electrical resistivity. This is more dynamic scattering, lifetime of the order of 120 femtoseconds from our analysis. It is associated with single polarons. And see, once again, as correlated polarons, single polarons are absent at low temperatures in the ferromagnetic state. They are present in the paramagnetic state, but we don't see any anomaly on the transition from the orthorhombic to the rhombohedral state, right? So it seems that single polarons don't do much as you go from one state to another state. And therefore, the following picture emerges in this phase diagram, that on the orthorhombic side, you have a paramagnetic insulator. On the rhombohedral side, you have paramagnetic metal, so no CMR here, large magnetoresistance there. You have polarons, which in our samples are dynamic, whether they're dynamic at all temperatures and in all samples, I cannot say, I don't have this information. But the important thing is that as you go from here through this boundary to there, it doesn't seem to be, you know, a significant anomaly in the population of single polarons. So there is probably a lot of change in the population of polarons as you go from here to there, right? But as it goes from through this line, there is not much going on in terms of single polarons. However, correlations suddenly disappear as you go from here to there. And here you have a lot of CMR, a lot of magnetoresistance. Here it's not. So it appears from this data that presence of the correlated lattice distortions distinguishes the metallic and the insulating paramagnetic states in the CMR manganite, and therefore important for the CMR. So that's the experimental result. The question, well, is this transition from the structural transition from the orthorhombic to rhombohedral driven by the localization of the carriers in the charged orbital or clusters? I don't know. Maybe there is. All right. I have probably 5 minutes left. So let me add the following. So firstly, one wonderful thing about this system, the manganites, is that you observe correlated clusters over a large range of chemical compositions, over a large range of doping, so they seem to be very robust. That's why I was talking about self-organization in this here. Now, what is the origin of this robustness? And I guess our organizer has more to say about this because I took this from his book, right? But in general, it appears that quench disorder plays an important role in these materials, specifically as you have, you know, two competing phases in the clean system. As you increase disorder, you end up in the following state, where in which these two phases are separated by the glassy phase-separated state, and in which you get the characteristic temperature above which the system, well, the system is homogeneous, and below which you have regions of coexisting phases. In the picture for manganites, you would have correlated polarons here, and maybe uncorrelated polarons on nothing there at high temperatures. As the distortion.
It looked like what we've seen this morning, right? It looked like only above the ferromagnet, you're piling up. This was kind of the shaded, the color picture. Mm-hmm. Only above the ferromagnet, you're seeing glass, and it's largest. We have the ferromagnet.
All right.
Know which largest.
All right. No. Okay, fine. This is not zero. Continue. Like you have the order stay there.
Still, I think the picture looked differently. Maybe it was just too suggestive, or I don't know. But it looked like it was really this glassy behavior as far as the crossover temperature was concerned. Mm-hmm. Was basically confined only to the region where you had the ferromagnet.
Say it again. There is another phase intervening there, right, at low temperatures.
Yes.
It's very generic phase diagram.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. The very generic?
The experimental one.
The one with everything.
Right.
Okay.
That you're talking about my little
polar on top.
Yeah, polar on head on top.
That's a good question. Yeah,
That's a good question, yes.
I mean, it hasn't really been mapped out in any detail.
This one.
This was more.
But left and right, did you imagine that
bend
this way? Or was this based on
this little thing that you have here. So, right. So the correlations are present, you know, here somewhere. Actually, not only here, but there too. They are present, you know, in this larger region. And they seem to be absent, you know, at high temperatures.
The picture I drew was the polar on glass. That's where we put an elastic component.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So on the as you go on the right hand side, you remember that TC and where the system gets truncated gets closer and closer. So
yes.
By the time you go up, that's 3/8 was the top of the, you know, and then you go a little bit further and there is no first order transition anymore. So that's how I drew the sign on that side. And then when you go on the other side, the discrepancy in TC for the isotope effect gets bigger and bigger. So we're guessing that
mm-hmm.
gets bigger on that side to some point, and then we don't know where it goes.
Right,
and then he's talking about the dynamics above that, right? Which I also
about. Yeah, so I'm talking about a slightly different thing. In fact, we don't have the phase diagram really mapped here, right? So I was talking about the temperature T star, right? About which you don't have any correlation,
yes.
And below which you do have the correlation. So it's somewhere here in this phase diagram, and as I said, you observe the correlations not only here, but, you know, for example, there too.
Your picture, right? You've got a mix of correlated and uncorrelated polarons, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And there's distinct entities.
This is what I'm trying to say, in a sense that you can have one without another. Yes. But in that sense. But whether the correlated peak really reflects, you know, the correlations of this single polaron, so whether it's something else.
Mm-hmm. But you would say you have the polaron glass beyond x equal 1/2?
No.
You do not? Okay,
no,
good.
No, that's right. Yeah,
okay.
It cuts out at about 0.4.
Right.
Sorry, 0.42.
Mm-hmm. But let me go back to this. Because what I wanted to say was really this. But in fact, there is a certain evidence for this picture in manganites, experimental evidence. And it is shown here. This is from Tomioka and Takura work. And in manganites, you can control the amount of disorder in the system, not only in the barium systems that Jeff was talking about this morning, in which you can completely get rid of the cation disorder by, you know, ordering these barium ions. But you can also do it differently by, for example, looking at the systems in which you have different ionic size variants. You can look at manganites with large variants in the cation size and with small variants in the cation size. And this is exactly what was done by Tomioka and Takura. Here, you get the system with small variation in the ionic size, and here is the system with large variation in the ionic size. And you can see that this phase diagram more or less resembles this one, right? And this more resembles like this one.
Well, there's much doubt that this picture is fundamentally correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is picture mm-hmm. these
Brennan-Pedalic
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. system. And doesn't, this is just an additional feature, I think.
Well, right. So, but you have correlated. You always have correlated clusters in this kind of right.
Because you're close to
yes,
the case,
that's right. Yes. Right. So now, and that would explain the robustness, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of quench disorder, you would get correlated clusters, perhaps in a large range of parameters. This is my point. All right. Now, this is not the entire story, however, because I was telling you that in a single sample, by a slight change of temperature, you can go through a first order transition in which you lose the correlations, right, of surrounding to rhombohedral transition. And of course, you don't change the amount of the quench disorder when you go through this transition at all. Right? So, this is not the entire story. So the system is more complicated, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know. And it appears that the effect of long-range strain might play a large role here, because after all, as I mentioned in the beginning, polaronic distortions are long-range, and effects of strain are well-known in manganites. I was saying something about the martensitic states and how by changing, for example, the grain size in the system, you can drive the system from one state to another. So manganites are extremely sensitive to long-range strains. So they must play an important role there. And perhaps, as you go, and perhaps they are responsible for this first-order type of transition from one state to another in which you lose the correlations. There are preliminary theoretical studies, some of them by our chairman and another by other groups, which seem to indicate that which seems to give support to the importance of the long-range strain, but I would call these models at this stage toy models, right?
Sure.
Okay, so.
Well, tomorrow we will hear from Alvarez and Tomen, you know, ways to go beyond the word toy.
Okay.
Some new techniques they have. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, yeah, these are very
simplified. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it seems fair to say that quench disorder and long-range strain are both very important ingredients there. All right, that's it, I guess. My main thought was that, in addition to what Jeff was saying, that the insulating character of the thorambic paramagnetic state in CMR manganite stems from the presence of the correlated lattice distortions, and the nanoscale homogeneity therefore play the key role in the CMR effect. They're not just a byproduct. Okay, thank you.
So we can have a few minutes for discussion if that for one to one. So maybe I can start. Can you sort of summarize again then what you view the role of the quench disorders having on correlated polarons? Correlated versus uncorrelated.
The only thought that I wanted really to convey was that you get these correlations in a very large range of parameters, chemical composition, doping level, right? And I just wanted to say that quench disorder may be the key factor that you have these correlations at all, right? Now, we don't have samples with zero quench disorder similar to the barium doped samples in a single crystal form in which we can really say that, oh, here we have them and here we don't, right? So we cannot at this stage experimentally probe them, but it seems that quench disorder is a factor that leads to the presence of the...
And so what's the reason that you would expect this? To me it seems really surprising.
Why quench disorder leads to the presence of the inhomogeneities in the system?
No, why you get correlated polarons out of that?
Oh, why I get correlated polarons out of that?
Yeah.
I guess you would get just polarons out of that, right? Now, that's one thing. Another thing is that disorders, the quench disorders that you would get in the system would be on a nanometer scale level. So perhaps that might lead to the presence of the correlations, but this is really all I have to say about it.
I have a fairly different interpretation of, in what we did, the disorder, what it does is it distorts a first order transition where there is an insulator element. The insulator contains this charge ordering or some sort of orbital and charge ordering, maybe not perfectly 3+ or 4+, but some sort of that. What you do with the disorder is locally stabilize bubbles of that competing phase. That happen to look like correlated polarons. There is, there is one polaron that is distorting this way and the next goes the other way and so on. That's the other phase. So we our visualization is that this is an island of a state that has an energy which is very close to the ferromagnetic phase. We never thought of calling that polarons or correlated polarons, but that's the language that my friends use, so I use that also. I think it's a different.
In your sense, it's not really correlated. There's something more akin to one of the fluctuations in the
surprise. So that would be an island, right? A droplet, right?
The disorder locally favors either one phase or the other. These two phases are very close in energy.
Yeah.
You introduce with quench disorder imbalances between the two. So at some point, the one that is above happens to be below, and so locally you stabilize this other phase. That looks like correlated polarons in the sense I mentioned, but you don't need to use that language. It's a bubble of a competing insulating phase that happened to be close in energy.
Thank you.
There is some work on magnetic polarons by Steve von Molnar in, I think, cadmium, manganese, telluride, or some such material, and they saw some very distinct signatures in the resistivity versus temperature.
Uh-huh.
So my question is basically, have you looked at, is there any similarity with that kind of data, and have you looked at?
I'm not familiar with that data, so.
Okay, maybe we can talk
about it. There is a similarity.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to talk a bit about that tomorrow.
Okay.
And I think everybody agrees that those are real polarons, I mean real trapped electrons. Lightly go.
Yeah.
One trouble is golden electrons.
You can not lie.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody agrees that.
Yeah. I'd like to raise a sort of bit of an objection to the importance of mm-hmm. polaron ordering.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that polarons would tend to order if they have interactions.
Mm-hmm.
That's present, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But how important that is, my question. If you could go back to the plot of the temperature versus the resistivity and the ordering several.
This?
Yeah, that's one.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that about this TS, the ordering is a TS,
mm-hmm.
but resistivity is quite high. So in terms of resistivity, the ordering contributes only 1/4.
Very good question.
So the polaron itself, means of charge localization. Therefore, that provides high resistivity. So, to me, that the question of ordering is just an additional, 1/4 or something, and not an overriding.
All right. So, okay. So, one thing is that we can only work at high temperatures in the system, right? At low temperatures, you get the ordered state. And we're trying to distinguish the metallic state from the insulating state based on the high temperature data, which is impossible, right? Which is just impossible. Secondly, this particular sample that I've shown you, the doping level 0.25 is kind of far from the ideal doping level. So there, even the ferromagnetic state is not such a good metal. So the temperature dependence, right? It is metallic, but it is not a good metal. And If you look at various theoretical models, for example, for the Mott insulators, then at high temperatures, it is even impossible to distinguish bad insulator from a bad metal. In other words, just the temperature dependence, up or down as a function of temperature, doesn't allow you to distinguish between these two things. What we know, however, is that on this left-hand side, when it is a surrounding, the temperature dependence, except for this very, very small region here, is insulating. There, it is metallic. Here, especially far from the optimum doping level, we get various things on the border.
The consequence, two consequences of the same order.
No, I think the answer to your question is that in the rhombohedral phase, there are only single chlorides and there's no CMR effect. And that's right. That's the interesting thing.
Yeah, that's the fine.
But there are single chlorides, whereas in the orthorhombic phase, there is a big CMR effect. And that's the interesting thing. That's why the chlorated chlorons are...
And whether you have a metal here or insulator there, it's... So whenever we are too close, we are very close to this boundary, it's even impossible to say what we have there, metal or insulator. And of course there are additional things that go in, right? We are not too close to the optimum doping level and additional things like this. But you're right, the drop is not too big, and even the temperature dependence look like an insulator. However, if you move just a little bit of this boundary, then it becomes looking like a metal. And this is a distorted system, right?
Are these quorum-quorum correlations driven by the orbital effect, or was driven by the fact that it's close to a 50-50, anti-baromagnetism that contributes a role? What I mean is that you're 50-50, you typically have orbital order first without long range anti-baromagnetic order. Mm-hmm. It seems like these short range charge correlations that everybody sees, even though around 30%, it's still the same type as a CE.
But I guess
the question is that, orbital driven or anti-baromagnetic driven?
The question is to Jeff, have you seen any interferomagnetic or magnetic signal associated with this?
He already knows the answer to that.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
The question is not for to an X-ray person, right? Because we don't see magnetism at all.
In the Langton calcium system, you don't see any antiferromagnetism in that system. And in fact, it's hard to see the magnetic part of the polarons, but in other systems, near X equal a half, you could see these very nicely.
The antiferromagnetism.
In one experiment we did, we discovered that when you go down, when the stuff orbital orders, you see this 50-50 thing, but your antiferromagnetism is actually extremely anisotropic. Your 3 plus, sort of little crystal-like structure, whereas your 4 plus is isotropic.
Right.
We don't actually understand it. to the extent. We're actually not sure that this is actually due to orbital driven or actually anti-ferromagnetism also plays a fundamental role, because there's a debate in the literature as to in the paramagnetic phase it's really orbital driven or the remnant of the anti-ferromagnetic phase.
Well, all this data that I've shown you tells you is about the latest distortion, right? It doesn't tell anything about the magnetism, so that has to be sorted out, I suppose. And as I said, we have models for whatever happens in these ordered regions, but these are models. We don't have the sole structure.
Okay. Are there any other questions before
Maybe just a follow-up. Should we better speak about a annealed rather than quantized order in this system?
Annealed or quenched? In the sense that it's frozen, it's a...
That's foundational definition?
That's...
Of what? Sorry, of existing disorder. I didn't understand. Definition of...
I mean, you have random distribution of the cations, right? And that this is frozen, doesn't change the function of temperature, right?
Issue, but rather than that the system tries to develop some, let me call it droplets for a moment, in whatever is the optimum arrangement for the system, this is not quenched, right? But rather the electron would be moving in something different, so we might have both. Just to talk about quenched disorder alone is
maybe not sufficient, right? I think we have both types of disorder in the system, which the carriers are really experiencing.
But I think the question was whether the quench disorder induces this inhomogeneous.
Yeah, also in the picture, maybe that the LVO is your face diagram, that says quench disorder is.
Well, what you put by hand in the sense of being frozen and it's the disorder that Valerie referred to. Now, what happens after electrons reaccommodate themselves is another. It's the consequence of that. It's a state that also.
I would say that as a consequence of the initial quench disorder, you would.
So the idea is that you introduce small amounts of quench disorder, and due to the proximity in energy of two phases, you generate big bubbles of those phases.
Okay, so meaning in the absence of the quench disorder to start with, the system might not self-generate these droplets?
Does occur. At least in some models, this is what comes up.
Okay.
Now, in other models that include these strain effects, there is a possibility of classic behavior emerging without quench disorder. Yes. Or at least we have a very tiny amount of disorder. Mm-hmm. There are these theories of glassiness that need an infinitesimal amount of disorder to travel to a long way field spot.
Thank you.
Okay. I think that we should move on to the next speaker.